probably not the right title, but that's all right. It's fair enough to have used that one. Yeah. So first of all, I'd like to thank the Institute and the organizing committee of Silverin for inviting me here, and also all of the audience for being here. Today I want to talk about the Berkovich projective line and how a rational function acts on it. This being a chalk talk, I'm not entirely sure how much of my outlined abstract will be covered, but I want to err on the side of being clear rather than in trying to write too many things. And so for that, another reason I've chosen to give a chalk talk. And if it turns out that tomorrow it's important to continue on and cover some things I didn't do today, we'll abbreviate that part. So one of the interesting things that has happened, I think, in the last 7 or 8 years is the realization that there's another domain closely related to the projective line over CP that perhaps is a better location for doing p-adic dynamics. This realization came to the surface sort of independently in several areas. Every good idea has several fathers. And the first person, I suppose, who really realized it was Juan Rivera Letelier, who in his thesis sort of by bare hands and independently constructed an object which turned out to be the Berkovich projective line. And being a true dynamicist as well as being an excellent mathematician, he kind of barehandedly created the entire theory of dynamics for the Berkovich projective line. In the meantime, Matt Baker and I had undertaken to try to prove equidistribution theorems, and we were led to use the Berkovich projective line as an appropriate place to have the analog of the Lubitsch Berlin Freire-Monnier Lopez measure. And we, not being dynamicists, were astounded to find out what Juan had already accomplished in his construction. And in the meantime, in France, Chambert Loire and his student Amaurice Thuillier had also undertaken to do equidistribution. Chambert Loire's point of view was from the higher dimensional one and from our Kalef theory, but he was led to this theory as well. And I regret to say that Matt and I kind of ambushed Amaurice, who was also an excellent student, excellent mathematicians, and he changed his thesis because of the conflict of these things. So it's an unfortunate overlapping history, but in any case, it's clear at the present time that sort of the right place to do p-adic dynamics is in Berkovich space. Here I've already gotten used to this thing here. So without wanting to discount what Rob did this morning, I think Rob's intuition is wonderful. I think that from a sort of a functorial and canonical nature, the Berkovich space is the quote right place to do non-Euclidean dynamics. So it's a somewhat more complicated domain. So I want to talk about, first of all, Berkovich space. The dynamics on it. So I want to contrast the projective line over CP and the Berkovich space over CP. So as Rob has pointed out already, the structure of P1 of CP is that it's topologically totally disconnected it's Kandersat-like. This has to be understood in some generalized limit sense, whereas P1 Berk is a space which contains P P1 of CP as a subset, you might say as its boundary, and it is path connected, in fact, uniquely path connected. And has an R-tree structure. So from the standpoint of connectivity, the Berkovich space is a much nicer object to work with than a Cantor set, and that's one of the reasons why geometric intuitions tend to work better for it. Secondly, as we've seen, P1 of CP is not compact, and it is not locally compact. But the Berkovich space is compact, and it is locally compact. In fact, it's a Hausdorff space, although this is also a Hausdorff space. On the deficit side, P1 of CP is a metric space, whereas the topology that P1 Burke has, well, it turns out to be metric kind of by accident, but the metric is not anything useful. So by this I mean that because of some second countability kinds of axioms and things, you can trace through the proof of Urysohn's metrizability theorem, that you find that there's a metric which induces the topology, but that metric is so unnatural that there is no point that I have found so far in making use of this metric. And if you have a field larger than CP, it may fail to be metrizable. So it's, again, kind of an accident that it's metrizable. So I want to today try to explain to you what the Berkovich space looks like, how it is that CP is, P1 CP is the boundary, and then to, in particular, try to explain how a rational function acts upon the Berkovich space. We'll then be in a position to try to do more things with it. So what is the Berkovich space? Now, I'm going to today only be talking about the Berkovich space over the field CP that Rob has described today. The field CP is a little bit special in several ways. First of all, it's a complete algebraically closed valued field with a non-Euclidean valuation. Its value group is isomorphic to Q. It's a rank 1 divisible group. So one can certainly find fields with much more complicated value groups. And likewise, its residue field is the algebraic closure of FP, the finite field, with P elements. And that means it's countable, that's one thing. But even more than that, it is the union of finite fields. And this fact that the residue field is a union of finite fields gives extremely strong automatic finiteness properties to the action of a rational function on the Berkovich space here, which simply are not true over arbitrary ground fields. So we're, even though CP sometimes seems like a very large and abstract object, in fact, it's got a lot of special arithmetic properties that don't appear in the ordinary case. Also, what is the Berkovich projective line? So it has to be understood that the Berkovich space is sort of the simplest of a large class of spaces which Vladimir Berkovich created to make a category that are kind of like manifolds in rigid analytic setting. So he realized that the category of rigid analytic spaces, which are the higher analog of p-adic kinds of spaces, weren't so good because they weren't as connected, they weren't compact. And so he created a class of points that you could use to fill up and make them be connected. And the Berkovich space is a locally ringed space, just like a scheme is. We are going to be today looking only at the underlying space and mostly entirely neglecting the sheaf of rings upon it, which is local rings of convergent power series. But it should be understood that this is part of a very large subject. And of course, P1 Berk is very special. It's the one-dimensional complete case of something, so you can expect that it should be nicer than many other things. But I can give a good description of this in general for higher dimensional Berkovich spaces. I don't think anybody can give a nice geometric description of what the object really is. So we're having an advantage in this. So there are various ways of looking at it. First of all, you can view it as the affine Berkovich line together with a single compactification point at infinity. That is probably the way I'll try to expose it today. It is also possible to view it as two copies of the affine Berkovich line glued via the map induced by z goes to 1 over z, just like the usual projective line can be viewed as two copies of affine line glued by the inversion along the point. And you can also view it as two copies of the Berkovich unit disk glued along the same map along the annulus. Taking away the interior. So I guess in Rob's notation, Rob would have been writing closed annuli here and B for open. I tend to write a minus for the open one, so if I slip into that notation, then please forgive me for doing that. So you can construct the Berkovich projective line in any of these constructions. Probably this one is the easiest one to initially explain, so let me try to just define as a point set what the Berkovich affine line is, and then we'll try to understand what it looks like topologically and what the topology on the space is. So Berkovich had to find a place to get more points from if you wanted to expand out the usual complex CP. And you can view CP as identifying it with the absolute values that come from evaluating a function on a point. That gives you a map. And so I guess Berkovich's original analysis approach was from a functional analysis point of view, where this is probably something that comes up more naturally. But he wanted to he defines this to be the set of all continuous multiplicative seminorms which are functions from the polynomial ring CP of T to the positive reals. So what does such an object have to do? So it has to satisfy the property that if you take a function, then it is the map f to f sub x is continuous in the usual topology on CP of T. So that's what takes care of the continuous part. It's equivalent to say that it's bounded, meaning that you have a norm on the coefficients that induces a corresponding norm. So you're going to require that f times g sub x is the product of the two norms. That's the multiplicative part. Now, in this case, we'll have automatically the inequality part that says that this thing is going to be equal to, less than or equal to the maximum of the soup norms of f and g. And I have to confess, I don't know whether I have needed to include this or not, but we certainly want to include the fact that if you have a constant, that it induces the usual p-adic absolute value on constants. That's part of the continuity assumption, I believe. And what is different, the semi-norm property, you require that f, of course, it can be zero, even though f is not zero. So that's what makes it into a semi-norm as opposed to a true norm. So as a point set, the Berkovich-Affine line is the collection of all such such objects. Now, if we're going to try to understand them, we ought to know what are these guys. And Berkovich has a nice theorem at the very beginning of his theory where he describes these seminorms as falling into one of four types. So, first of all, four types. Type one, we have things which take f goes to the evaluation of f at a point x for a point x in CP. So if you have a function, you can evaluate it at that point and then take its usual absolute value. And that will give you a function which satisfies the first three properties, but it can vanish on certain points. For example, if f of, let's say, z is equal to z minus x, then you can have that f, that z minus x at the point x, that's equal to zero. So you can certainly have functions which are killed by this type of norm. In fact, this is the only kind for which the objects will not be actual true norms. These are the semi-norm ones. And so you can see in this sense that CP is contained in the Berkovich-Affine line over CP. And so this is the identification that corresponds to have CP as kind of the boundary of the Berkovich space. It naturally sits inside as a collection of type 1 points. So what are the other types? Okay, so if you have ever worked with non-Archimedean things, you realize that a function on a disk with radius in the value group tends to take its maximum absolute value a lot more than a function of the complexes does. It takes its maximum absolute value everywhere except on a finite number of sub-open balls. And so the type of function of type 2 is f goes to, I should have said equals here, it's equal to the maximum for z in some disk of the absolute value of f of z in the p-adic absolute value. So where d of ar is a ball, the set of z's in CP such that the absolute value of z minus a is less than or equal to r, and r is in that value group of CP cross. Now, I hope that I haven't already done it too much. I tend to write d for balls in the classical set here. So d, if I write a d, tends to mean a subset of CP, and I tend to write b for balls in Berkovich space. So my d and my b is not exactly a typo, though it might appear to be a confusion at some point. So the crucial part in this situation is that the radius belongs to the value group, which tells you this max is taken on a lot. On the other hand, you could take points for which you have a disk whose radius does not belong to the value group. In that case, you won't be able to take a max. In fact, it will never be taken on, but you could take a soup. So fx is equal to the soup over the disk where, in this case, r is definitely not in the value group of CP cross. So these are sort of more generalized but still quite classical points where the action is taking place relative to a classical disk, but you're just taking the supernormal over something that wasn't really truly achieved. So this is type 3. And type 4 are the exotic ones, and they have relation to the fact that the field CP is not spherically complete, as Rob pointed out this morning. So if you have a collection of nested disks, and the intersection of these disks is empty, then you could take one of the corresponding soup norms that you had up above for each of the disks. Just by automatic construction, you can see that for a fixed f, you'll get a decreasing limit on these soup norms. And so since a decreasing limit of positive numbers has to reach a limit, you can see that the corresponding point, which is the limit as I goes to infinity, of the corresponding soup norm, I haven't written it down, but I should perhaps have written it in this situation here. You're taking the limit of these things as a decreasing limit. This, of course, is equal to the soup norm of F on that corresponding disk. So these four types of points, Berkovich says, are the only ones that there are. The only way you can build a bounded multiplicative seminorm that agrees with CP, or the usual absolute value on CP. Now, I had said that this thing is kind of has a tree structure, so I want to explain how these objects organize themselves into paths and trees. So if we fix a point A and consider the disks D of A, R for, let's say, some range of values of the radius between two values, then we will have a corresponding list of seminorms which fall into a naturally parametrized family corresponding to the corresponding point. So I've written x as a general subscript value here, but this is equal to the soup norm on the disk of radius r about the point a. At the top, we have f, I might call x1, which is x2 perhaps, is equal to the soup norm of f over the disk of here, and we have f x1 is equal to the soup norm of f on the disk of radius r1. And you can see these form a nice continuously smoothly varying family that falls into a natural one-dimensional line like this. Now, if we were to continue this thing down, we could actually find at the end of this thing, if I've assumed r was greater than 0, we have proper disks. But if we were to take r to be equal to 0, then you can have the absolute value of f at the point A corresponding, as it were, to the soup norm of a disk of radius 0, and that's kind of a degenerate situation. I'm sorry to be, I guess probably people can't see this at the very bottom there, so I'll try not to use this blackboard like this anymore. So you can continue down. Of course, you can continue upwards as well as you wanted, and so you would find that you had a situation where you have a line that goes up to infinity, and you have a line that goes from A to infinity, and a path of arbitrary length. Now, if you were to have started with a second point B, and you were to continue to do the same thing, you have this line now corresponding to disks of radius BR, you would find that the line would continue for a while, but at a certain radius, you have that the two disks coalesce. This is because, as Rob said, the Narcabidian property means that when you reach the distance between the two points, the two disks, both points lie in the same disk, and for everywhere above it, these two points continue on arbitrarily far. Well, this could be done for a point C, and you know, you can have a point C which maybe joins this one, and you might have that there's a point B that comes up to a third point and so forth. And so we have here a clearly one-dimensional tree-like object, which is where this R-tree type structure comes in. But now let's think about this a little bit further. So for some of these points, the ones which have values with R in the value group of CP cross, then you have a way of changing coordinates so that you were to have, you could divide by some number which has absolute value here and make this be like the usual disk. And you'll find out that the number of branches that come off of this thing are in one-to-one correspondence with the points of the projective line over FP bar. So the branches in here are in one-to-one correspondence with the points of P1 of FP bar. Well, there are countably many branches. So at a point like this, we don't just have a finite number of branches, but we have countably many branches. The FPs go down, and the one of them, the infinity point, goes, as it were, up. Now, there are lots and lots of guys like this. This is an element of a dense set in the reals. And at every type of point like that, we have these terribly branching points. So you can see that we have a dense set where the countable branching takes place. This is a fantastic or terrible, as you view it, witch's broom of branching branched branches. And so you have this immensely densely branched object of frantically branching and rebranching branches. Every branch branches itself off and continues on like this. Okay, so the Berkovich space, at least this part of what we looked at, which so far only consists of the points of the first three types, looks exactly like this terribly, fantastically, countably branching branch collection of branches that are coming down from infinity and branching fiercely as you come down. Now, we can play this game backwards. So let's just suppose that we had ourselves a series of nested disks like this, and we were to follow those things down from some point. So we come here and we have the disk D of A1, R1. We have the disk D of A2, R2. I'm writing some abusive notation, the norm corresponding to this point. We continue down D of A3, R3, and we keep on going. We find out that because the intersection is empty, after a time we peter out. And we have to enter an end here to close this thing off. In order to make the thing compact, we have to add some new points. Those are the type 4 points that we add on, the type 4 points. That are meant, are needed to close off the branches that continue in this way. Okay, so that's how all of these things fit together into a single tree-like structure, and you can see how it is indeed path-connected and uniquely path-connected, because if you want to get from one point to another, you go up to their common join, you go back down to the other point, and there's only one way to do it. You can't do it any other way. So it is uniquely path-connected. Now, I said it was compact and locally compact. That I won't prove for you. It's a general phenomenon that has to do with the fact that, well, I haven't even said the topology yet, so I should do that next. But there are a couple of topologies that can be put on this thing, and the topology that we want to use is commonly called the weak topology or the Gelfand topology. Let's see. I don't know where we should put that apostrophe. Is it here? So it's the weakest one for which all maps of the form X goes to F sub X are continuous. For F's in the polynomial ring. So we're simply demanding that if you have a fixed polynomial you love, that the map which takes X to the value of the polynomial, that seminorm, is a continuous function on the space in this way. Now, it is possible in this case, because of the one-dimensional nature of everything, to see that a basis for the open set are given by the subsets corresponding to open affinoids. So I'm going to write this with a little bit of abusive notation. D of A R minus the union I equals 1 through M of certain other disks which are smaller. Now, what actually happens in this situation is that we have, let's say we have a point X, and we have coming down from this thing all these branches, and going up there branches that go out as well. And so what happens is that you have a finite number of boundary points which we're going to cut off. So this one corresponds to D of AR, the upper end here, and we have a finite number of them coming down as well, which we're going to cut out. And so we have here D of A1, R1, D of A2, R2, and so forth, D of AN, RN. And so we're cutting out everything that was originally on those lines and everything below and above them, and what is left is a basic open set. Okay, so you can see that in some sense this is a very weak topology. You're only allowed to cut out a finite number of things. It's also sometimes called the observer topology, because the observer standing at one of these points looking backwards towards X sees everything here. You have a finite number of observers It's the collection of things that a finite number of observers facing towards X could simultaneously see. So this turns out to be the collection of basic open sets that you can get by this means here. Now, it turns out that there's a second topology called the strong topology. Or path distance. That also comes into play. I can describe it to the following way. If we had the collection of two disks, D of AR and D of A capital R, then the distance between these two things, rho, I'll call these things X1 and X2, X1 and X2, that's going to be the log of the ratio of the two things. I, again, have to slip off this a little bit. This only works on everything except for the type 1 points, and you can make another metric which doesn't take this logarithm and you difference the two radii. But I'm not going to talk about that one. So anyway, it's in this topology here that the thing is compact, but not metric. In this, obviously, it's metric, but unfortunately is not compact or not locally compact. So there are two topologies that go on parts of it, and the one that we're interested in most studying is this weak topology where the thing is compact.
Do people use these strong topologies?
Yes, in fact, that was probably the most unique and original part of Rivera's work, in that Rivera's point of view was that the P1 of CP was the basic object, and he created this affine hyperplane that was above it, and he put the strong topology on it, and he was able to use facts about the strong topology to deduce facts about P1 of CP, whereas my point of view is that sort of P1 Burke is the interesting thing, and there are times when this is necessary to use, but it's not the topology I use all the time. So having described the topology, I hope the structure of what this thing looks like, I now want to talk about how a rational function acts upon the Berkovich space. Okay, so first, we have to realize that all the semi-norms of types 2, 3, and 4 are actually true norms. This kind is not a norm, it has a kernel, but these three things are true norms. And so for a true norm, you can extend the norm to the quotient field by the usual quotient structure. So if you have a quotient of two polynomials
then you can just take the corresponding quotient of the two polynomials, and this turns out to be well-defined. Now, in thinking about this, you have to realize that for a type 2 point, you know, this soup norm is being taken on just lots and lots and lots of times, not just in an isolated place, and the same is true for the soup norm of G. So this is kind of like taking the generic value of this function rather than taking some other soup norm value. So you should really think about these things as being like the generic absolute value of a function on the point rather than on being the soup norm. Of course, we already know how a rational function acts on classical points. If you don't know that, then you should be back somewhere in high school. So we really only have to describe how the action works. But the action is the following one. So phi acts in the way that we ask that a function f at phi of x should be defined to be the soup norm on f composed with phi at the point x. Okay, so it's the obvious functorial pullback kind of action. Once we know that these things are true norms, this makes sense. And on type 1 points, it's the usual action on the specialization ring on the corresponding point. So this is how a rational function acts. It clearly gives an action. Now, what can we say about this action? So it's not quite so obvious, but it has various kinds of properties that are nice. It's continuous. And secondly, it is surjective. It's maybe not immediately clear. It is surjective. And it is an open mapping. So not only is this property hits everyone P1, but it takes an open set to an open set. Might have ought to have said that it extends the usual action . So if you're looking at the bottom of this thing, yeah, so how does P1 Burke look? So how many of you have seen these lightning generator devices that they have in stores? So you have this electric thing and it sends out these flashing lightning bolts out to the various outsides. This is how I like to think about what P1 Burke looks like. So on the outside, you have all the points that correspond to P1 of CP, and on the inside, you have the all possible paths of these lightning bolts that extend out from the center being called the Gauss point. So what you're having is some strange action of a rational function on P1 of CP, and interiorly, this thing has to be extended in a continuous way to act on all these paths as well. So that is how the action works. Now, what can we say about this action? Well, first of all, it preserves the types. It takes type 1 points to type 1 points, type 2 to type 2, type 3 to type 3, type 4 to type 4. So if the image is type 3, it had to have come from a type 3. If the image is type 4, it had to come from type 4. It's perhaps, we already know how it acts on type 1 points, so on type 2 points, we can understand it pretty well, too. So if we're given a point, let's say x, which corresponds to a disk of radius little r here, And we have, as I've said, this is a type 2 point, so that R is in the value group of CP cross. And we have phi of x, the image, which corresponds to another disk, D of B of capital R in the supernorm case. How can we identify what these two disks are? Well, you can change coordinates on the source and the target. So we're viewing phi as a map from P1 Burke to itself, but we'd like to separate out the source and the target and change coordinates separately on each one. So in the source, we can find an isomorphism between this disk and the usual disk D of 0, 1. And then over here, we can change coordinates so that this disk, by a different change of coordinates than this one here, becomes D of 0, 1. And in that case, you have a new map, which is gotten by taking the two change of coordinates that are like this, and we have a new map that, because of its nature, has a quotient of is a quotient of two polynomials with integer coefficients, and I might call this thing, I don't know what I want to call it, but I'll call it F. So anyway, we can reduce this thing mod P. So F tilde in FP of T is non-constant. And so, in fact, it turns out that there's only one change of coordinates that you can possibly make such that when you make this reduction map, the resulting map will be a well-defined non-constant function in FP tilde of T. And if you can find such a coordinate system, then that is the image of this point. So here is an example of that. How should I do this one? This one wants me to use the front board first. How's my time doing? I'm all right. So here is an example. So I'm going to take P equals 5. We're working over C5, Rob's choice of the canonical prime. It's odd. It's not too big, not too small. And phi of T will be equal to T squared minus 1 over T squared minus 16. Okay, so what can we see about this thing here? So you can see that if you reduce this thing mod P, you'll get the constant function T squared minus 1 over T squared minus 1. You get T squared minus 1 over T squared minus 1, because 16 is congruent to 1 mod 5. And so this is equal to a constant. So something is not kosher right here. But I'm going to take my point to start with to be the point corresponding to D of 0, 1, so I don't have to make the change of coordinates at the start. Okay. Now, how can I cleverly observe what kind of coordinate change I ought to make in order to make this thing appear as a non-constant function? Well, we can see, in fact, that no matter what x we put in here, we'll see that phi of x is always congruent to 1 mod 5 for any x in D of 0, 1. Oh, yes, there are two x's that we don't want to put in. Those are the ones that are not congruent to plus or minus 4. So we're allowed to throw out a finite number of points. So this suggests that what we ought to do is maybe subtract 1 from this thing. So we'll take t squared minus 1 over 16, t squared minus 16 minus 1. That's going to give us 15 over t squared minus 16. And this looks much better. It doesn't have the t squared in the top. But unfortunately, it's divisible by 5. So we now want to take 1/5 of that thing. And so we'll now get 3 over t squared minus 16. And this is our function f tittle of t, which is a non-constant function. So what does this tell us? This says that this is taken to the point that corresponds to the disk of radius 1/5. Sorry about that. Radius 1/5 about the point 1. So we've been able to guess a coordinate change that gives us this mapping. And so this thing takes that type 2 point to the other type 2 point there. Okay, I'm probably going to need to abbreviate my talk in some extent, but the next topic you can view as perhaps being sort of the climax of the development here. The wonderful thing is that there is a theory of multiplicities for points in Berkovich space, which extends the usual one for points in P1 of CP. So, for example, if you had the function phi of t to be equal to t squared over t squared minus 16, I'm not going to continue this example much, you can see that at x equals to 0, this thing has a has multiplicity 2. Whereas at the points 4 and minus 4, then it has multiplicity 1 because it has a single order pole. Now you can do the same kind of subtraction for any other point. So we're talking about the usual multiplicity, the order of the 0 at the given points. So the usual algebraic multiplicity is the order of vanishing of the function at that point when you change coordinates to make it in make it 0. So what does this theory of multiplicities look like? So in general, there are various ways of defining this thing. We can define m phi of x to be the limit as we take a cofinal collection of neighborhoods u. So again, we're talking about neighborhoods over here as being these things in which you're allowed to delete a finite number of branches. If you cut out more branches, you get smaller and smaller neighborhoods. You can cut out as many as you want, so you can eliminate all the points you want. You're talking about points that, however, are still kind of generic near being by the type thing. So the definition of this thing would be the soup over z's in u intersect p1 of cp. So we're talking about classical points of the number of zi's such that phi of zi is equal to phi of z. So you're trying to find out how many times does a given value get taken on in this given neighborhood. And Rob was alluding to this in his talk earlier. He said that there's this notion of the local multiplicities of the coverings, the d1, d2, d3, and so forth. That's the multiplicity that's assigned to the point that corresponds to the point on the interior of this. You can make this more precise if you want to and have it be equal for a certain class of neighborhoods. So this multiplicity has the property that if you consider for each y, the sum over the x's which have that image, it's equal to the degree of phi. So this is the first fundamental property that is like the one that happens for classical multiplicities. The sum of the multiplicities of the pre-images is equal to the degree of phi for every point. So this has a consequence. I mentioned that this thing is open. This openness is a consequence of this degree formula, though I don't want to describe the proof. I guess it's also clear surjectivity follows, right? If every point is hit degree number of times, it's definitely surjectivity. So we have surjectivity coming up. Okay, so for type 2 points, remember the ones corresponding to disks that have radii in the valuation group, then there are other formulas that work. So it turns out that we had the multiplicity of x is equal to the degree of this function f twiddle that I had defined on this board here. We've got this unique function f twiddle that is the reduction. So in our example, the if x corresponds to the unit disk with phi of t being equal to t squared minus 1 over t squared minus 16, then we can see that the multiplicity of this point is equal to 2 because the degree of that thing was 2. But there are lots of times when it turns out to be 1. Yep, there are a lot of interesting geometric properties that are related to these multiplicities, and that's truly why they're so useful in studying the Berkovich action. So we should also talk about the tangent space. So if we have a type 2 point, which is the case I'm most interested in, we can see that we have all these paths coming out that are coming out from it in all these different directions. But you can see that there's an equivalence notion of paths, namely two paths are equivalent if they share a common initial segment. And so we can identify paths in the same equivalent direction as being like a tangent vector. So you can see that a tangent vector V is an equivalence class of paths. The equivalence relation being that they share a common initial segment. Sort of by definition, two paths are continuous. We can see that the vectors are in one-to-one correspondence with elements of the residue field. And so there is an induced action of the tangent vectors that correspond to this. So not only does phi act upon the function, the points, but it also acts on the tangent vectors, and it's the induced action that you get by letting f tilde act on the corresponding points. So phi acts on the tangent vectors. I'm probably about out of time. So we have phi star from t sub x to t sub phi of x takes the tangent vectors of one point to another. So let's us again see how this thing works out in our example at hand here. So we have this point x, which corresponds to d of 0, 1, and we're taking this thing down to the point that was the ball corresponding to that ball. And we have seen that f twiddle in this case t turned out to be the map, what, 3 over t squared minus 16? Is that what I got from that case? Okay. Now, you can see that f tilde prime is equal to calculus here. What does it turn out to be? It's 3 times minus 2t over t squared minus 16 squared. So there's a critical point at z equals to 0. That means that in the tangent direction that's coming down towards 0, that is taken to a single tangent direction. On the other hand, we have the two tangent directions corresponding to plus and minus 4. So here's V4, and here we have V minus 4. Those are both taken up to the direction infinity because they're poles of the corresponding thing. So we have two separate directions that these things are sent with. So it turns out that there's a relationship between the multiplicity. I've drawn this vector twice as long as that one is. That's no accident. The multiplicity of the reduction function in this direction is the sort of the length that things are stretched locally by. Okay, so I'm going to stop with this thing here, but I'll just say that Rivera-Letelier classifies fixed points in P1 of Birk minus P1 of CP, so the non-classical ones, as being indifferent if the multiplicity is 1 and repelling if the multiplicity of phi is greater than 1. And you can see the reason why this is the case if you believe my hastily drawn diagram. So what makes a point repelling in Berkovich space? Well, if you have a fixed point, this one's not fixed, the directions kind of get moved around by a degree 1 map. The directions are kept the same length. But if you have a reduction of degree at least 2, it has at least 1 critical point. So there will be some direction where there's a jet that shoots out. So you can imagine the action of a rational function in the neighborhood of a fixed point of multiplicity bigger than 2 as being kind of like an accretion disk around a quasar, right? So a quasar is swirling around madly, and out of a few directions it has these jets where it's expelling mass. And it's in that sense that you have a repelling point at a point of multiplicity bigger than 1. It's not repelling in every direction, but it's repelling in some directions. Okay, so this is just a start of the description of the action. I'll continue on with probably a different start on it tomorrow, and I hope this is a start on understanding the action of a rational function on Berkovich space.